Our analysis shows that the premium should go down by 20%, so that's going to be helpful not only for the people that are getting subsidies, but also for the people that don't get subsidies.
The state's program to help people buy health insurance gets federal funding. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 11th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, what it takes to save the long-lived rockfish.
They're subject to barrel trauma. You've probably seen where their stomach comes out, their eyes pop out. And
those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has given the green light to the state of Alaska's reinsurance program, which helps many people who buy their own health insurance. Healthcare Administrator Seema Verma, who oversees the Obama-era healthcare law for the Trump administration, says the approval means federal money will flow to the state to shore up Alaska's individual health insurance market, about $48 million next year.
Our analysis shows that the premium should go down by 20%, so that's going to be helpful not only for the people that are getting subsidies, but also for the people that don't get subsidies. So we're very enthusiastic about this.
Alaska is the first to get what's known as a state innovation waiver under the Affordable Care Act. Although the federal government will now fund most of Alaska's reinsurance program, the state designed it to avoid adding to the federal deficit. It's essentially a pay-it-forward approach. The state legislature kicked off the program last year by paying $55 million for reinsurance. That covered insurance claims for some of the most expensive Alaskans in the risk pool. It held premiums down for everybody, and the state says saved the federal government about $50 million that it did not have to pay in premium subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. The government has essentially agreed to send that savings to Alaska to bring down premiums more and entice more uninsured Alaskans to buy coverage. Senator Lisa Murkowski says a more stable market could attract another insurer to provide competition.
The hope is that you don't need to have this backstop going well out into the future.
The news comes as Senate Republicans are trying to fashion a replacement bill for the Affordable Care Act. Senator Dan Sullivan says the draft he's seen would allow the innovation funds to continue and has other similar programs for the states. Like Murkowski, Sullivan says the news of the government's waiver doesn't make it more likely he'll vote for or against the health care bill.
You know, I wouldn't connect them directly in terms of, oh, just because this happened, that makes it more likely.
Aviva Arendine is a fan of the Alaska Innovation Waiver. She's a fellow at the Center for Budget Policies and Priorities, a left-of-center think tank.
This is a model of the, you know, the road not taken so far in Washington, which is actually focusing on specific identifiable challenges and trying to craft specific solutions that make things work better instead of trying to tear down the entire structure, which so far is what Congress has been focused on.
The innovation waiver is set to last 5 years for a total of about $330 million, though that amount would vary from year to year, especially if a new health care law lowers Alaska's insurance subsidies. The state of Alaska will not be providing voter information to the White House for the time being. The Trump administration's Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity has suspended its request for voter information from the Alaska Division of Elections. The commission's nationwide voter fraud investigation has been put on hold because of a pending lawsuit by the Electronic Privacy Information Center. The lawsuit alleges that the commission failed to ensure that submitted data would be secure. It also says the request for voter information is a violation of citizens' constitutional right to privacy. On June 28th, the Election Integrity Commission's vice chair, Chris Kobach, sent a letter to Alaska Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott requesting all publicly available voter information. Under state law, some information, such as a voter's driver's license number, social security information, and date of birth, birth is confidential. State had been preparing a response that only contained information available under the Alaska Public Records Act. According to the governor's deputy spokesperson, Jonathan Taylor, the commission has functionally withdrawn their original request for data, and the state will not be providing any. NBC News reports that 19 states had refused the original request for data. 26 other states, including Alaska, agreed to only private data that was already publicly available. Kodiak Island's rocket launch facility was one of the players in a missile defense test this week. According to a Missile Defense Agency press release, a U.S. Air Force C-17 aircraft air-launched the missile in the Pacific Ocean north of Hawaii, and a weapon system based in Kodiak then detected, tracked, and intercepted it. The Alaska Aerospace Corporation and Kodiak is a multi-year agreement with the U.S. Department of Defense Missile Defense Agency. Alaska Aerospace CEO Craig Campbell says the deal is for a maximum of just over $80 million.
For this year, they're going to be doing a couple launches of the THAAD mission, the Terminal High Altitude Air Defense program that the United States military has been actively using for a while.
United States missile defense has drawn a lot of attention following a North Korea missile test last week. The U.S. Department of Defense reported that, according to U.S. Pacific Command, North Korea launched a missile on July 4th, which traveled for 37 minutes and landed in the Sea of Japan. This most recent U.S. exercise tested defense against an intermediate-range missile. A U.S. defense official said they could not confirm the exact time the launch took place, but it was overnight between Monday and Tuesday. He added that the intercept used kinetic energy. A video of the incident shows a burst of flame upon impact and debris falling into the ocean. The MDA press release states that this is the 14th successful intercept out of 14 attempts for the THAAD weapon system. The EPA has announced its intention to reverse course on an action to thwart the proposed pebble mine in the Bristol Bay watershed. The Obama administration's Clean Water Act restrictions, if finalized, would have made it hard for Pebble Limited Partnership to develop a major gold and copper deposit in southwest Alaska. Pebble filed a lawsuit against the EPA in May. As part of the settlement, the EPA agreed to begin undoing its so-called preemptive veto of the project. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt says he wants to give Pebble a fair chance to apply for a permit. The EPA's notice in the Federal Register is expected within days. It kicks off a 90-day comment period. United Tribes of Bristol Bay, commercial fishermen, and lodge owners in the region have waged an intense campaign against the mine, despite Pebble's promise of environmental safeguards. Pebble CEO Tom Collier says the partnership is working on a plan for a smaller mine that he hopes to make public later this year. The former head of Alaska's Railroad Workers Union has been sentenced to a year in jail for felony embezzlement. According to the U.S. District Attorney's Office in Anchorage, Jeffrey Davies of Wasilla pleaded guilty to the charges last year, admitting he took $90,000 of the union's money for personal gain over a three-year period. The case followed an investigation by the FBI. When handing down the sentence, District Judge Sharon Gleason said that Davies had grossly abused his position of trust with his fellow union members. In addition to spending a year and one day in prison, Davies will be on probation for another 3 years and pay nearly $93,000 in restitution to the Alaska Railroad Workers Union. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Tlingit civil rights leader will be joining the flip side of the future dollar coins.
We can't think of a better way to honor the memory of her as our civil rights leader and that landmark passage.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Someone is interested in buying the retired ferry Taku. As a result, the Alaska Marine Highway System is giving interested parties an extra week and a half to submit bids. Spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says the new deadline came at the request of an interested party.
Obviously, there's not a huge rush on this. We have been working with the TAC coup for several months now, so we were happy to fulfill that request.
Bailey says the Marine Highway is not identifying the interested party or parties. The 54-year-old ship has been out of service for 2 years. It's been put out to bid twice before, first at $1.5 million, then at $700,000, but no offers were made. The latest attempt, advertised June 19th, listed no minimum price. Bids were scheduled to open last Friday. That deadline was then extended until July 18th. The Taku was taken out of service in 2015 to save money. It worked, but needed minor repairs and certifications required for all passenger ships. If it can't be sold, then it could be scrapped. State biologists are trying to conserve long-lived, slow-growing rockfish in southeast waters. For the first time ever this August, they're closing the rockfish sport fisheries and requiring anglers to make sure the fish they do catch are returned to the water safely. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The roster of non-pelagic rockfish sounds like the currency of an exotic country.
Quillbacks are real common, coppers. And then there's some small ones that are also common, rose sorns, canaries.
Troy Tydenko sits at a table in his office in Sitka, where he's the sport fish management biologist. Spread out before him is what appears to be a fairly menacing arsenal of tools to hook, pinch, clamp, or otherwise catch fish. But actually, this is life-saving equipment for rockfish.
The idea with pretty much all of them are that you're going to be able to get a rockfish back down at depth. And, you know, because rockfish have got that closed swim bladder, when you bring them up, they're subject to barotrauma. You've probably seen where their stomach comes out and their bodies pop out. And if you can get them back down quickly, where they're back under pressure, kind of reverses those effects.
Barotrauma is as deadly as it sounds. Tydenko says only 20% of rockfish survive it. The distended swim bladder doesn't allow them to return to the bottom, and they remain helpless on the surface, easy pickings for an eagle. On the other hand, 95% of the rockfish released with one of these devices live. For 3 weeks, from August 1st through 22nd, sport anglers in outside waters are going to have to let all non-pelagic rockfish go at 100 feet of depth. Just as charter operators have been doing for several years, all fishermen are going to have a deep release mechanism with them on the boat. Doesn't have to be fancy, even though it can be. Tydenko's got one he's made from an 8-inch piece of rebar with a big fishing hook taped to it. The barb on the hook has been pinched down.
Usually the way I use this is that same hole that you catch the fish in. I just put the hook through there and then just send it down.
Tydenko ties 100 feet of line to his homemade release mechanism and cleats it off to his boat. When the rockfish is back under pressure, it recovers instantly, slides off the hook, and heads for the bottom. Another commercial mechanism has a pressure-activated switch that allows users to choose a depth.
Some people use these on their downrigger. Send them down and they pop right open.
This is the first time ADF&G has closed the rockfish sport fishery, but it's not out of concern that sport anglers have been catching too many. According to data gathered in the statewide harvest survey, creel survey, and charter logbooks, the harvest has remained fairly constant at about 16% of the total allowable catch, or TAC, for non-pelagic rockfish. Instead, it's the TAC itself that's dropping, from 66 metric tons in 2006 to 35 metric tons this year. This is of concern. Rockfish don't rebound the way some other species do. In fact, their lifespans are better than ours.
They vary by species. A big, especially a big yellow eye, it's not uncommon for them to exceed 100 years.
And Tydenko says they're slow to reproduce. Again, depending on the species, some rockfish don't reach sexual maturity for at least 12 years. Other than conserving stocks, there's no biological objective behind the August closure. We could have chosen any 3 weeks, Tydenko says. We wanted to make sure there were plenty of coho around to target instead. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Nooshogak River is having a near-record return of sockeye salmon. Normally, the river is more famous for the strength of its king return, when many other Alaska rivers have struggled. This year, though, the king run has been low, or at least late, to the frustration of the anglers who line the river's banks in June or July. Some sport fish operators say they'd like to see some changes in the commercial sockeye fishery downstream to help protect the kings. KDLG's Allison Mollenkamp has more.
There is no formal forecast issued for Nooshogak kings anymore, but going into the season, state biologists felt it would be another good year. But the season got off to an achingly slow start just as anglers showed up to fish the famous waters. On June 21st, sport fishing guide Chris Carr lent voice to how few kings had gotten upstream thus far.
2 days ago, we set the net, let it sit overnight, and that was a mistake. It took my daughter and all, everything we had to pull that thing up. So we took another nice brand new net, set it on this morning's side, let it sit for 6 hours, and same thing, not one fish and every web covered in the green algae.
The kings trickled in, but not on an escapement curve that suggested it would make its 95,000 in-river goal. Early on, the numbers of kings counted at the Portage Creek sonar site showed something was off. Alaska Sportsman's Lodge King Camp manager Jeff Fender says his repeat clients could tell, too.
Like I said, too, it's our clients that have been here that know that, and it's a slow day when you're out there watching the tip of the rod, and you're knowing, God, normally I can catch 20 a day, and I'm struggling to get my 4 or 5 out of the day, and I know that the client is sitting there thinking the same thing, too. So
anglers know that fishing is fishing, and there are few guarantees when booking any trip tied to Alaska salmon. However, Fender, who has 23 years' experience with this river, has been frustrated by what he sees as a chance to place a greater priority on protecting kings.
The biologists that manage this area, I know they have mandates and management plans in place, and it's upsetting that they won't take the initiative, even though those mandates are there, to see how hard the kings are being hit this year.
The upriver anglers are about the last in line to get a chance at the kings, after the commercial sockeye fishermen net up tens of thousands and subsistence fishing around Dillingham harvests around 12,000. This frustrates the clients of Bob Toman, the founder of Toman's King Camp on the Nooshogak.
It's the last one to get the fish. The first ones are caught out in the ocean by, you know, like salmon, by trollers and stuff. And then they get closer, the gill netters get them, and then the sports guys get them. So if any of those over harvest, then there's not enough left for us to, and then for the fishing game to meet their quotas.
Jeff Fender said repeatedly that he doesn't see this as an issue of sport versus commercial, which breeds some of the ugliest fish politics from other Alaska fisheries. However, he does hope that perhaps the commercial fleet could pause to help out the king numbers.
You know, I'd like to see at least every other tide be unnetted and allowed to come in the river. It may only take 1 or 2 days to jump us above our minimum escapement goals on kings.
But while the kings have lagged, the Nooshogak sockeye are returning in some of the highest numbers ever recorded. Pausing the commercial fishing downstream would only allow more over-escapement, something area management biologist Tim Sands doesn't see as an option.
Our system's so dynamic. We have these huge masses of sockeye coming in. Taking a tide off is catastrophic, potentially.
The Nooshogak-Mulchatna King Salmon Management Plan governs decisions on the sport, subsistence, and commercial fishing of this species. Former ADF&G sport fish biologist Dan Dunaway helped draft those rules, which he believes have largely been successful.
There's been a lot of dissatisfaction expressed by some sport folks over the way the plan worked out, but it's what was politically viable at the time in front of the Board of Fish and with the local users of all groups.
Dunaway added that he would be interested to see parts of the plan reviewed. The King Run continues to build slowly, creeping towards the lower end of its goal. It's possible they're just running late this year, perhaps due to the low water or lack of windy days that normally push fish. If the run comes in on size, likely most concerns will be calmed, but if the numbers stay low, proposals may emerge to change the management plan. I'm Allison Mollenkamp.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, whose goal is safe and responsible operations of the Point Thompson facility. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
Wrangell has a new agreement with its unionized workers. If approved by the Borough Assembly, it'll end 3 years of sometimes acrimonious talks over wages and benefits. International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers members went on strike June 22nd. That came after the Assembly approved the borough's final contract offer, which workers had already rejected. The strike ended about a week later after the two sides returned to the bargaining table. But the municipality rejected a new union contract proposal. Rather than return to the picket lines, workers asked for more negotiations. Interim borough manager Carol Rushmore says the talks led to new terms.
There's basically one change from the contract that the Assembly ratified on June 20th, and it has to do with the health and wellness benefit, the medical benefits for union members.
Assembly members will hold a special meeting Thursday evening to consider amending the contract they've already passed. Rushmore will recommend approval. The union voted in favor of the agreement at a Monday meeting. 24 Wrangell employees are represented by the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Another 35 management and non-union staffers also work for the borough. The assembly will discuss the contract change behind closed doors, then vote in a public meeting. Some of Alaska's firefighters are headed to the lower 48 to help with blazes raging from Washington to New Mexico. The state's Division of Forestry says they're retaining enough resources to respond to any fires that might occur in Alaska. So far this year, the fire season's been quiet. On average, 1.2 million acres burn every year. As of this morning, fewer than 340,000 have seen wildfire damage. Most of the current fires are in remote, drier parts of Northeast Alaska. And when it comes to weather in the 49th state, anything is possible, including snow in July. According to Brian Brentschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment, Alaska holds the North American record for the most snow in July. Back in 1970, on July 19th, it snowed 9.7 inches at the Summit Weather Station just south of Cantwell on the Parks Highway. Brentschneider told editor Annie Feit 16 stations in Alaska have recorded snow in July.
To get snow in July, kind of a lot of things have to come together, but it's most likely to occur north of the Brooks Range. So on the North Slope, Barrow or Utiaugvik has recorded snow a number of days. Over to the west of there, like say at Wainwright and then Cape Lisburn, and then east toward Kektovik or Barter Island, also a number of snow days. Once you get south of say the Brooks Range, the snow observations are all going to be at higher elevations. So places say generally above 2,000 feet. So it's still uncommon, but not unheard of.
And what does have to come together for it to snow in July?
So to get snow in July, usually it's going to be associated with like an upper level low pressure system. You know, the big L's on the map. You know, not necessarily like one of those Gulf of Alaska storms that's moving in. It's going to be something that's packing its own kind of cold air punch at you know several thousand feet up. And then when you get heavy precipitation. It can actually drag that cold air down. So often you see, it'll be maybe 35, 40 degrees in rain, but then as the precipitation intensity increases, it'll drag that cold air down and transition to snow. So but again, it's an uncommon event, but not unheard of.
How much snow are we talking?
Well, generally, July snow events, August snow events are light snow events. So a tenth of an inch, 2/10 of an inch. But there are a couple instances where there's been greater than 6 inches. So back in 1976, up at Cape Lisburn, they had 7.2 inches of snow on July 4th, 1976. And then at the Summit Weather Service office in July 1970, they had 9.7 inches on July 19th. So that's not only an Alaska record, but that's a United States record that appears to be a North America record. In fact, it's so unusual that it's been flagged by the National Center for Environmental Information as being an outlier, that it's probably bad data. But there's actually a Weather Service staffed person there to record it. So it almost certainly did actually occur.
Brian Brentschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. 2020 dollar coin honoring Elizabeth Peratrovich will either have a literal image of the Alaska Native civil rights leader on it, or a raven holding a key, a symbol of her Tlingit raven moiety and her role in agitating for an anti-discrimination law. While a final decision by the head of the Treasury Department is months away, KTUO's Trip Krause explains what's gone into getting the Peratrovich onto the flip side of the Sacagawea dollar coin up to this point.
Since 2009, the reverse of the Sacagawea dollar coins have been redesigned annually to honor Native American heritage. The coins aren't made for general circulation anymore, though coin collectors do buy them directly from the U.S. Mint above face value. Mike White has been with the U.S. Mint for 28 years.
For each year, we go to our staff of artists, and they generate designs. We consult with various Native American groups.
A team of five artists in Philadelphia worked with various stakeholders on coin designs, including the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Tribes of Alaska, the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, and U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski. The artists want to ensure the designs fit historically and culturally.
We've got a very talented group of artists that works on them. And when we go before the committees, we try to give a real variety of designs and a good representation of whatever the theme that's chosen that year.
The organizations he's referring to are the Citizens Coinage Advisory Committee and the Commission of Fine Arts. The Coin Advisory Committee endorsed the raven perched on a door handle grasping a key. The Fine Arts Commission chose a design showing a three-quarters profile of Peratovich with a symbol of her Tlingit raven moiety. The abridged version of Peratovich's story begins when she and her husband moved from Kluwak to Juneau in the 1930s or 40s. As Alaska Native Sisterhood Grand President Cecilia Tavallero tells it, the couple faced housing discrimination because they were Alaska Native.
They found there were barriers, and they were not subtle like they are now. It was very blatant that they were disrespected and told that they couldn't live in certain areas, and they took objection to that and decided to do something about it.
With the support of Alaska Native Sisterhood and Alaska Native Brotherhood, Tavallero says Peratovich took the fight to the Alaska Territorial Legislature.
Seeming like David and Goliath, because there were very many of the senators speaking very blatant negatives about the Native people, and basically calling the Native people inferior.
Peratovich is credited with successfully advocating for the passage of Alaska Territory's Anti-Discrimination Act of 1945. Alaska became the first U.S. state or territory with such a law, which guaranteed equal voting rights and equal access to commercial accommodations and services, years before the civil rights movement protesting racial segregation in the lower 48. Rayanne Holmes is the communications coordinator for the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. She says the coin is an exciting recognition.
It's, you know, a perfect way to mark the 75th anniversary of the state of Alaska's Anti-Discrimination Act of 1945. So we can't think of a better way to honor the memory of her as our civil rights leader and that landmark passage.
In Juneau, I'm Trip J. Krause.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Henry Leisha and Annie Fight in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ed Schoenfeld and Trip J. Krause in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Allison Mollenkamp in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, Ann Hillman produced tonight's broadcast, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.